the littler iPad. A little bit late to the party, not Apple's usual timing. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update Podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich, and it is the 23rd of October, a Tuesday. We're going to talk about the big iPad mini release, and we'll also talk to our man in China to dissect all the China talk from last night's debate. And we're going to hear about a newspaper investigation in Ohio. They looked into businesses that took stimulus dollars by the millions and now back candidates who say the stimulus was a terrible idea.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
As I speak these words this hour, it has not happened just yet, but at midday today, tech types will gather around their screens, big and small, for the latest unveiling from Apple. It is widely believed this will be a smaller version of the iPad. For now, people are calling it the iPad Mini, which might or might not be the actual name. Dan Seitz is a tech writer, and you can read him various places, including the pop culture site Up Rocks. That's Up Rocks with two X's at the end. Dan, good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on.
As usual with these things, we think we know a lot about what's coming. What do we think we know about the iPad Mini?
Essentially, it's going to be a 7-inch iPad 2. At least that's what the rumors are saying. I wouldn't be surprised if the processor is a little faster than the standard iPad 2, but it's essentially going to be that with a couple of inches chopped off on it.
Steve Jobs notoriously said in 2010 that tablets this size would never take off. Seems he was wrong about that. What's the niche that they are turning out to fill?
It kind of sits between an e-reader and a full-fledged tablet. For example, I'm an owner of a Nexus 7, and it's a good utility tool to have around if you just need to get on the internet, hop on Wi-Fi at Starbucks, but don't want to lug the laptop, the keyboard, if you don't need the camera, the back-facing camera.
There is a lot of competition out there already for tablets this size. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Samsung. Mm-hmm. Is this the rare case of Apple playing catch-up?
I would feel that it is. The iPad, as it stands, is, you know, far and away the most competitive tablet in its sector. There really hasn't been anything that's come close. That said, coming into this market, you have the Nexus 7, which has been an excellently reviewed and well-selling tablet. You have the Kindle Fire, which is really closely tied to Amazon and really appeals to folks who primarily use their tablets for e-readers. And as you mentioned, there's also the Barnes & Noble Nook, which can also serve as either, like, a tablet or as a media streamer. So I think Apple is coming in with a bit of a disadvantage here. I have no question that they're going to sell quite a lot of these. I just don't know that they're going to dominate the sector like they have in 10-inch tablets.
Dan Seitz is a tech writer, writes for a number of sites, including uprocks.com. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, let's do the numbers. Yeah, a couple hours into the morning, it is bad out there. Not even the iPad Mini can perk up Wall Street and seems unlikely to turn around, but who knows? It's early yet. The latest batch of underwhelming earnings and the usual worries from Europe so far adding up to a big drop on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 236 points at this hour, 1.7%. The S&P and the NASDAQ similarly down early in trading. Those global gloomy earnings forecasts came from 3M, UPS, and DuPont. DuPont seems to be getting hammered most of all. It is down at this moment 9%. Facebook earnings come out after the bell today, and that will cheer everybody up, right? While we're talking markets, high-frequency trading, it's the computer-based buying and then selling of shares within fractions of a second. Some 60% of U.S. stock trades, if you can believe it, are carried out this way. High-speed trading's been blamed for the so-called flash crash and for stacking the deck against ordinary investors. But now a new report from Britain says this kind of trading is mainly beneficial. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
The study is the most comprehensive of its kind, drawing on 150 experts from 20 countries. The lead author is the British government's chief scientific advisor, Professor John Beddington. He says high-frequency trading is not as bad as it may seem.
There are definitely benefits in terms of sort of liquidity and their general efficiency of markets.
That means quicker and cheaper share dealing for all, but critics point to the flash crash. In May 2010, the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged almost 10% and then bounced back within minutes. Beddington concedes that high-frequency trading may have this effect.
There was a real potential for feedbacks between computer programs to exacerbate fluctuations in trades.
He's calling for closer surveillance and more research, but he rejects a plan by the European Parliament to force high-frequency trading systems to slow down and take at least half a second to carry out a trade. Today's report says that would not be good for the market. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Weather Channel Companies has decided its name no longer fits. The company's dumping the word channel to reflect its broader scope. It's hardly the first company to change its name with the times. Apple, after all, used to be Apple Computers. Dropping a word is one way to rebrand yourself. But what about using words that aren't words at all? From WBUR in Boston, here's Doug Trabue.
The online financial services company Covestor lets customers mirror trades made by experienced investors. With the business model mapped out, the founder and some employees headed to a London pub to settle on a name. Over a few pints, Covestor beat out the exciting, but decidedly less relevant, Orange Comet. In industries that are a little dry, an unusual name can change the conversation.
When you hear the word insurance, what do you think of? Complexity, jargon, bureaucracy, inflexibility.
Hal Belidoff runs the parent company of Plymouth Rock Assurance. That's assurance with an A. Belidoff says the insurance company lives up to its name with programs like Cab Fare for policyholders who feel unsafe getting behind the wheel. The company was founded in Massachusetts in 1982, but assurance became its marketing focus when new state regulations attracted larger competitors about 5 years ago.
And we had to figure out a way that we could distinguish ourselves among the noise and the clutter that is filling the airwaves all over the country.
And they're not alone in tweaking the I word.
Then there's Esurance. Born online, raised by technology, and majors in efficiency.
That's actor John Krasinski, the voice of Allstate's web-based car insurance company, Esurance. If discussing auto insurance isn't exactly fun, talking about dental work is like, well, pulling teeth. Probably no coincidence that dental benefits administrator DentaQuest has a program called Preventistry.
People don't care about brands. They don't care about advertising. Unless it has some effect on them.
Boston University communications professor John Verrett is the former head of the advertising agency Arnold Worldwide.
Preventistry doesn't mean a darn thing. Esurance, assurance doesn't mean anything unless there's a consumer benefit that goes along with it.
In other words, what's in a name is up to the customers. I'm Doug Trabue for Marketplace.
And speaking of names, Rolling Stone reports hip-hop power couple Jay-Z and Beyoncé have been dealt kind of a setback by Uncle Sam. The two attempted to trademark the unusual name of their daughter, Blue Ivy, as a brand name for their own line of baby products they hope to roll out. And it might have been possible, if not for an objection by Blue Ivy Events, a Boston wedding planning business founded in 2009, back when Blue Ivy, the baby, was just a bling-bling in her daddy's eye.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
This week, the way Texas funds public schools is on trial. Districts across the nation have seen tough budget cuts in recent years. And as in Texas, some are going to court to fix what they call an unfair system. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports now from San Antonio.
In Texas, not all school districts are created equal. Some are property wealthy, many are property poor. And since school property taxes pay for everything from chalk to sheetrock, poor school districts are frequently failing at educating their students to the standards set by the state. Teedra Robertson is with the Texas Equity Center.
The school districts are asked to do more with less money. They've had to cut the amount of teachers, cut their support staff.
On Monday, lawyers for several school districts argued the Texas school funding system is so hopelessly broken that it violates the state constitution. The Texas Association of Business agrees, along with James Galson of the Conservative Texas Public Policy Foundation.
We're not getting the most out of our education dollars right now.
If the judge finds that the Texas Constitution is being violated, it'll likely be up to the state legislature to find a solution that'll have to please the judge, the school districts, and the business community. In San Antonio, I'm David Martin Davies for Marketplace.
Now to talk a little bit about last night's presidential debate, which was focused, as you probably know, on foreign policy. Specifically, we're going to home in on the part of the debate in which the candidates talked about China. And they talked about it in a somewhat similar way much of the time.
China's both an adversary, but also a potential partner in the international community if it's following the rules.
We can be a partner with China. We don't have to be an adversary in any way, shape, or form. We can work with them. We can collaborate with them if they're willing to be responsible.
Earlier today, my colleague Jeremy Hobson talked with Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz, who's hanging out for us in Shanghai. Here's Jeremy.
So, Rob, what did we hear new about China, if anything, last night?
Not much. I mean, Obama stuck to his administration's record of trade action against China in the WTO, and he said that the best way to compete with China is to improve America's education system. I think the most surprising thing was that Governor Romney took a much more conciliatory approach toward China than in the previous debates. He still did say, though, that he'd label China a currency manipulator on day one, and nearly all economists say this is a bad move. I spoke with Bill Bishop, who runs the Chinese media site Cynicism, about Romney's approach, and here's what he said.
Other than the currency manipulator declaration, he's basically pursuing the same policy towards China that Obama is pursuing and that President George W. Bush pursued and that President Bill Clinton pursued and President George H.W. Bush pursued.
So maybe not that much difference between them. Well, Rob, let me get a quick fact check from you on another subject that came up. President Obama was talking about Mitt Romney's stance on the auto industry bailout here in this country, and here's what he said.
If we had taken your advice, Governor Romney, about our auto industry, we'd be buying cars from China instead of selling cars to China.
So, Rob, what are the numbers when it comes to our car trade with China?
Well, first off, Chinese automakers aren't exporting to the U.S. because their cars have a long way to go before American consumers would consider buying them. But with regards to the U.S. auto industry, when Obama took office, the U.S. exported around $1 billion worth of cars to China. Last year, we exported five times that. So the bailout of GM has helped the company enjoy incredible success here in China. GM sold its 1,000,000th vehicle here in China this year, and they're selling more cars here in China than they are in the U.S.
Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeremy.
One notable moment in that vice presidential debate came when Joe Biden pointed out that Paul Ryan had requested stimulus dollars for businesses in his district. This week, a newspaper in the pivotal swing state of Ohio investigated a similar phenomenon, whether business interests that received money from the stimulus were now backing Republicans who are trashing it. The Cleveland Plain Dealer looked specifically at energy grants and loans and found a number of examples around their region. Stephen Koff is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Plain Dealer. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, Jeff. Good to be here.
So give me a good example of what you found.
Well, Easton Town Center, a shopping center in this Columbus, Ohio suburbs, is a pretty good example. It's a successful center, upscale center. Got $911,000 to install some LED lighting and make some other energy efficiency improvements. And while there's nothing wrong with doing that, and the money was certainly available, it so happens that Limited Brands, which is chaired by Leslie Wexner, has a substantial interest in that shopping center. And Leslie Wexner donated $250,000 to Restore Our Future, which is a super PAC that supports Mitt Romney and wants to stop reckless government spending.
You found a number of examples like that in your region. You asked Obama's Ohio campaign what they thought, and they called it hypocrisy at its finest. Does this make these businesses hypocritical, or are they just doing the practical thing in their best economic interest at the time?
It absolutely is in their best economic interest at the time. No question about that. The real question has to do with then what are their personal choices and their decisions, and are they consistent or inconsistent? You get a variety of viewpoints on that. On the one hand, look, the money is available. It's perfectly legal. On the other hand, if we want to talk about stopping reckless spending, where do you start? Where do you draw the line?
There are also a number of links in the chain between the people who are making the donations and the businesses that are maybe choosing whether or not to accept stimulus funds.
Without question. These are not entirely the people who are necessarily signing the form or signing the application, although actually in the case of this particular shopping center, one of the principals was in fact signing the forms and doing the application for the energy money. But yeah, there are others involved, and the chairman of the company isn't necessarily going to know where every penny of a capital improvement project came from.
Stephen Koff is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And finally, the historical references were flying at last night's foreign policy debate. Among other things, President Obama reminded Mitt Romney the military days of horses and bayonets are over. Well, this morning, Joe Biden has taken things positively prehistoric. On CBS's The Early Show, Biden accused the Romney-Ryan ticket of, quote, rattling the saber tooth. Hey, Mr. Vice President, the Pleistocene called. They want their metaphor back. This has been the Marketplace Midday Update Podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich, and you're listening to APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.